From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Powerful political crosswinds are buffeting the Democratic Party these days, pushing it in opposite directions. To make Trump a one-term president, some urge the party to embrace the center. But a series of powerful issues, from police brutality to economic and racial inequality to climate change, are empowering the progressive wing of the party. A string of recent primary victories are evidence of that, including a big upset in Missouri this week. This hour On Point, progressives and the future of the Democratic Party. Let's kick this off with Cori Bush. She's a progressive activist and now the Democratic candidate for Missouri's 1st congressional district. In Tuesday's Democratic primary, she defeated 10-term incumbent Congressman William Lacey Clay. Cori Bush is a single mother, a former nurse, and a pastor, and she's expected to become the first black woman to represent the state of Missouri in Congress. She joins us now from St. Louis. And Cori Bush, congratulations on your victory and welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So you beat William Lacey Clay. His father represented that district before him. So people in this district have been voting for someone named Clay for a long, long time. How did you beat him?
It took people power. People power and a lot of organizing and having the same message. I've had the same message since 2016 that I really pushed hard on in 2018. And I've been active in my community for many years. So people know of me being an active leader.
Right, right. Now, you were supported by Justice Democrats, a progressive group that's supporting progressive candidates across the country. To what extent do you see yourself as representing a generational and a progressive split within the Democratic Party?
Look, I think that people are so ready to see something different than what they've seen. Because, you know, what we've had has been okay, but so many things are happening in our communities that need to be addressed now. So I believe when people see someone like me, someone who is just a regular everyday person, an essential worker, working class nurse, you know, single parent, someone who's been unhoused, been uninsured, been a low wage worker, a survivor of sexual assault and domestic violence, when people see that, you know, it speaks to them, and it's also signaling. So it's not just signaling to the community, hey, we need a regular everyday person in Congress, but it's signaling to other people saying, hey, I can do this too. I can run. And so because these are my values. And so people, I believe that more people are going to step up, and we're going to see I believe it'll stop being called progressive, but we won't be called progressive so much as we'll be just called Democrats.
Right. Just called Democrats. Among other things, you're known for being a leader in the expanding protest movement around racial justice. And this dates back, for people who don't know a whole lot about you in other parts of the country, this dates back to the police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson. You were really drawn into that protest and were very present. Now you're a proponent of defunding the police as one example of a policy you're talking about. What does that mean to you? Because it means different things to different people.
Yeah, defunding to me means a reallocation of funds. So it doesn't mean the police will be, you know, won't be funded. They will be funded. What it means is they won't be overfunded in some areas. So because we have other areas in our communities that are underfunded. So when COVID-19 hit the St. Louis area, we needed more money for human services. We needed to be able to get our unhoused population off of the streets and get them into a place where they would be safe and that they could have the supplies that they needed and the protection that they needed, but we did. The money was not there. We needed more money for health and hospitals. It took North St. Louis City and parts of North County in St. Louis It took us too long to get the COVID-19 supplies and testing that we needed. Had we had more money already available, it maybe wouldn't have taken so long. So we need to. So the money that the police have for tear gas and bear mace and more SWAT gear to sit up and stockpile all of that, you know, rubber bullets, we can use that money and put that to better use. And what we need to do is we need to have social workers be social workers and police not be social workers. You know, we don't need them to do the job of all of these other folks. We don't need them being in our schools, being the educators. We need our social workers and therapists in those places.
Right, right. So I'd love it if you could talk about your view of what Democrats need to do to defeat Donald Trump in November, and specifically how your brand of progressive politics, and there are more and more of you in Congress now and soon heading to Congress, how your brand of progressive politics can do that.
So what I'm doing right now, let me just say, I was a Bernie Sanders supporter. I've been a Bernie Sanders supporter since 2015, actually, the first time I heard him speak. And but I understand right now that Senator Sanders is not the nominee. And so even though I don't agree with everything that, that Joe Biden is pushing and standing for, I do realize, though, that Donald Trump and his administration is hurting my community, hurting communities all across this country in ways that have set us back so far. We've been fighting and struggling, and we have the pain, especially Black and brown communities and women, marginalized communities, LGBT communities, the disabled community. We have the pain of this, the regular struggle of everyday life that we had before Donald Trump took office. Now it's even worse. So I keep that on my forehead. Like, that is a sticker on my forehead that reminds me every day that we have to fight. So whatever we got to do to get that man out. So if it's going to be Joe Biden, then fine. He is not going to be Donald Trump for us. And so that's what I'm keeping. So I'm out. I'm going to be galvanizing voters to get out and turn out.
All right. So in your view, your sort of energy leading toward November, the election in November, is a whole lot more about defeating Donald Trump than a huge vote of confidence for Joe Biden, it sounds like.
Well, it's going to take work. I don't believe that that we can't. So we've already started to see Joe Biden, make some leeway has been made, especially as it relates to like climate change. And, he's been listening and making some changes, not as much as I would like to see. But, that's just what it is right now. I tell you what, he's not. He's not somebody that's going to call out. I don't believe that he's somebody that will be pushing back the Black community and allowing hatred to fester in this community and grow, and push out racist views. I don't believe he's going to be that person. So we'll call him to the carpet if he does. But I don't believe that's who he's going to be. So absolutely. However it has to happen, regardless, or even if it's however it has to happen, we need him to slide in. We need Joe Biden to slide in, whatever the reason.
All right. What do you say to some in your party who say the best way to beat Trump in November is with a more moderate brand of politics that appeals to lots of, for example, suburban voters and independents, to a more moderate brand of politics that might be different from the kind of politics that you represent? What do you say to that?
I have to say that we need to look at what's happening right now. We need to really think about that, because I literally just won, and beat out a 10-term incumbent that has run the same type of race for the last 10 terms, that came in after his dad, a 52 year dynasty of people really feeling like this person was a moderate, even though they had some progressive views on some things. And so we need to pay attention to that. What we did was we brought in people that were disenfranchised voters, people that had never voted before, or people that, just were undecided. We brought them to the table, and that's how we won this race. So we need to think about that, because we have a lot of people right now saying, I'm not going to go ahead and vote. So we need to make sure that we are making a stand, and sometimes being that moderate kind of, we have to pay attention to the climate. George Floyd protests, Breonna Taylor protests, people fighting against COVID-19 and how that has destroyed their communities, fighting for essential workers. We need to be bold in that stance.
All right. Well, Cori Bush, she defeated 10-term Congressman William Lacy Clay of Missouri in this week's primary election, and she is going to be, in all probability, the first African-American woman congresswoman to represent Missouri in history. Cori Bush, again, congratulations, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It was a real pleasure. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Kimberly Atkins. She's a longtime political journalist, a member of the Boston Globe editorial board, and I should add that she's an illustrious alum of our host station, WBUR. Kimberly, welcome back to On Point. Always good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. And you're going to be with us for the rest of the hour, and we've got a lot of interesting voices to bring in. But really interesting moment here. As we mentioned, Cori Bush, sort of an indication of this progressive movement, increasingly flexing its muscle within the Democratic Party. What are your thoughts about this?
Yes, I think that this victory and the ousting of a longtime, and I should say very popular, a member of Congress, a dean of the Congressional Black Caucus, really reflects one of the ways in which the Democratic Party is changing. You know, we've long had the sense that sometimes when lawmakers are in a place too long, voters really develop a throw the bums out mentality. But what is striking about this win and other wins is that it's not necessarily a call to say that these other lawmakers were unpopular or weren't doing good work, but it's that the voters are expecting different things and they are willing to give someone else a shot at bringing in those policies. And it's a very similar energy that you saw in the election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez when she defeated a longtime incumbent, Jim Crowley, who was a member of Democratic leadership. We saw that with Ayanna Pressley defending Michael Capuano. You know, I covered that race and I couldn't get anybody to say a bad thing about Michael Capuano. Yeah. But what voters were saying was they wanted something different. And they thought that Congresswoman Pressley represented that district better. So we are seeing the Democratic Party shift leftward in a lot of these districts in a way that seems to be ahead of what Democratic leadership here in Congress in Washington looks like.
Really, really interesting. Well, we're coming up against a break, Kimberly, but when we come back, you know, I want to talk a little more with you about this and the fact that we're less than 3 months away from the general election and how you think this affects Democrats' chances or strategy as Joe Biden prepares for his final push against Donald Trump. So we'll pick up that after the break. We're talking about the recent string of electoral successes by progressive Democratic candidates and what it means for the party and its efforts to defeat Donald Trump in November. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're looking at the Democratic Party, more specifically at the party's progressive wing and its impact on the November election and the future of the party. My guest is Kimberly Atkins, member of the Boston Globe editorial board. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. And let's hear a little sound that relates to this subject. In June, Jamal Bowman, a former middle school principal, pulled off a huge upset when he unseated 16-term Democrat Elliot Engel in New York, in the New York primary. Here he was on election night as the results were rolling in and his victory appeared assured.
If the results continue to bear out as they are bearing out this evening, and we get to Congress, it will be our job to hold Donald Trump accountable and to hold every elected official accountable that continues to be beholden to corporate interests, that continues to be beholden to the wealthy, and is not fighting for the poor and is not fighting for the working class in our country.
That's Jamal Bowman after he won his primary. And Kimberly, we should also mention another name, Marie Newman of Illinois, another progressive who defeated Congressman Dan Lipinski, a conservative Democrat who, among other things, opposed abortion rights and the Affordable Care Act. So there's real momentum here, building on, as you mentioned, Ayanna Pressley, Ocasio-Cortez. The squad is bigger now. So we're less than 3 months away from the general election. How do you think this affects Democrats' chances or strategies as Joe Biden prepares for this final push to defeat Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think it's a real a bellwether that Democrats should be paying close attention to, more established Democrats, that is. And I include, of course, Joe Biden in that category. A lot of times when you've seen from within the Democratic Party a real pushback against these sort of challenges to sitting incumbents, the reason that folks in establishment give us is to say, look, we're trying to ensure Democratic unity. We're trying to keep the party together so that they can hang on to the House, so that they can win big elections, including the presidential, and that it's not meant to be a slight against these challengers, these insurgents, but really to try to protect the party. I think that argument is harder to make because, as I said, the party is changing, both based on the politics and Donald Trump in response to Donald Trump, but also the events of the world. I mean, think about it. This pandemic, healthcare has always been a top issue for voters. This pandemic has pushed support from Medicare for All to its highest levels ever. It's also made voters more, not less, concerned about things like climate change. And we've certainly seen an expansion in the support for really big criminal justice reforms like defunding or refunding police, reallocating police funding to other places that Cori Bush just talked about. We're seeing more voters, and not just voters of color and people in urban centers, but suburbanites, exurbanites, voters from all demographics when it comes to education or when it comes to income. We are literally seeing this party shift in a way that shows that the voters are demanding more progressive policies in response to what is going on in real time. So Joe Biden has been pushed to the left by this. He has people who he leans on, like Elizabeth Warren and other progressives, who have been making it their job to do that. And I don't think that's a bad policy. It seems that that will make it more likely that you will energize the base of Democratic voters if the goal, as Cori Bush said, if the ultimate goal is defeating Donald Trump in November.
Yeah, because it's interesting, and I agree with everything you said, and it was interesting listening to Cori Bush, because obviously there wasn't a huge amount of enthusiasm for Joe Biden. She said she was a Bernie Sanders supporter. But the point that she made about how her brand of politics and what she's advocating for right now could help Joe Biden and the Democrats in November is this idea that she's expanding the electorate, that she's bringing more folks into the Democratic Party who will actually vote. Does that sound like a fair argument to you?
I think that's absolutely right. And that's not to say that there is no one in the Democratic Party who has more moderate views or who still want to see Donald Trump defeated, but who have reservations about Medicare for All and who have reservations about some of the other policies that are being pushed by some of these candidates. I think the point you're making is right. I think there is an argument for Democrats to say, hey, we are the big tent party. And we can, you know, even those in the establishment can say, you know what, district by district, we can hash out these issues and let the best candidate win. And at the end of the day, retaining control of the House and trying to regain control of the Senate and White House are the ultimate goal that everybody can get behind, whether Joe Biden was your first choice in the primary or not.
It's interesting, too, because, you know, what I heard Cori Bush saying as well is, you know, we're going to do everything we can to make sure Joe Biden gets in there because we've got to get Donald Trump out. But, you know, if he doesn't, you know, let's assume he's president. If he doesn't sort of adhere to what we're interested in, he's going to hear from us. And so this leads me to another question I want to talk to you about. And, you know, assuming Joe Biden wins, what does the growth of the progressive wing within his party pretend for him as president?
Yeah, well, it means at the very least that he has to listen to them and have a seat at the table for views from throughout the Democratic Party, because he's going to need those folks, depending on what he decides to do in 2024, behind him with the same full-throated support that they have or that folks like Cori Bush hope that they have in 2020 in an effort to defeat Donald Trump. And I think we've already seen him doing that. I mean, certainly the fact that Elizabeth Warren has been one of his top advisors since he won the nomination, became the presumptive nominee for the party, in the fact that he is reaching out to others, you are seeing that happen more and more. anymore. And it's also worth pointing out that every progressive in Congress, even, they don't all work in the same way. I mean, you see, it's not every progressive getting in there and trying to break things up and you know, really shake these up to the point that the members of the Democratic establishment don't back them. I mean, Ayanna Pressley is one of the most popular lawmakers in Washington, and she is unabashedly progressive, but she will work across ideological lines to get the policies that she wants passed. But at the same time, she didn't come in trying to be beholden to the leadership, but still she's been able to have a really successful first term. So I think there are a lot of ways for progressives to work within the Democratic establishment. That doesn't mean that they're at odds with it. Joe Biden's going to have to figure out a way to maneuver that and adapt to that if he does make it to the Oval Office.
Right, right. And if he does, that will be an interesting thing to watch. Kimberly, I want to introduce an important voice from, I guess, what you could call the mainstream of the Democratic Party. Paul Begala joins us from Washington, D.C. He's a Democratic political strategist. He was chief strategist for the 1992 Clinton-Gore campaign, counselor to President Clinton. Now he's a commentator for CNN and professor of public policy at Georgetown University. He's also out with a new book just out this week called You're Fired, The Perfect Guide to Beating Donald Trump. And you can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Paul Begala, such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Well, Anthony, thanks so much. It's great to be on here. I'm a big fan of On Point.
Well, I appreciate that. We're a big fan of yours. So I want to talk about your new book in a moment. But first, weigh in on this fundamental question. Does this generational shift and leftward lurch within the Democratic Party help or hurt Democrats' chances to defeat Donald Trump in November?
Well, first, I just want to say I agreed with everything Kimberly said. I don't even know if you need me. It's an admission against interest. My publisher will shoot me for saying
okay, well, it was great for you to come on. Thanks a lot. Have a nice
day.
Thank
you and good night. No, she's exactly right. I don't think it's left-right so much as it is generational. You know, the Democratic Party needs new blood. And I don't care if it comes from the left ventricle or the right ventricle. You know, we need this. The Democrats need this. They need this energy. I listened to your interview with Ms. Bush. I heard your tape and seen other interviews with Mr. Bowman, these new, young, energetic progressives coming into the party. And just as Kimberly said, they are committed to working for progressive change. Joe Biden was probably Ms. Bush's third or fourth or fifth choice. But what did she tell you? She's going to bust her tail to elect him. And of course, everybody will hold accountable President Biden if we get one. But that's a high class problem to have as a political party. And I don't want to fall into the sort of both siderism. The Republican Party has a civil war. There are women and men who worked for George W. Bush who are now helping Joe Biden, supporting Joe Biden. In fact, President Bush didn't even vote for Donald Trump. They have a real civil war in their party. There's no never Biden Democrats. There are some folks who are more progressive and more leftist and some who are more moderate. That's fine. That's a political party. But it's not the same as what the Republicans are going through.
Yeah. And by the way, I just want to say to Kimberly, because Kimberly's in Washington and I'm in Boston, we can't see each other. I want to encourage Kimberly to jump in and with her own questions about this, because she's really good at this business. But here's another question that I have, Paul. And that is, and maybe we can dispense with this really, really quickly, but if the presidential election comes down to sort of who can best woo those independent voters, those moderate voters, who some of whom voted for Trump in 2016. There's evidence that a lot of them are sort of drifting away. Is there a risk that the progressive message and of defunding the police and, you know, protesting in the streets could turn off those voters, or even allow Donald Trump to make the case, look what's happening in the streets, and I'm having to send in the troops to retain order and so on and so forth. Is there a risk that the progressive sort of energy can go too far within the Democratic Party?
I suppose there's always a risk, but that energy has not manifested itself in violence. What Donald Trump is saying and what Fox News is saying is simply false. I look at surveys and polls all the time, but also voters show this in their performance. The overwhelming majority of white people support Black Lives Matter. I saw a poll, Anthony, 58% of police support Black Lives Matter. I mean, this is the mainstream position in America. And I think Trump is sort of trying to run a George Wallace campaign you know, in a Barack Obama world. And it's just not going to work. There is the key here, I think, for Democrats is it's very hard to hold together a broad, diverse, multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-gender, multi-generational party. But it's very good training to become president of a country that is all those things, too. And I think that that's the challenge here. But the truth is, the crises we face in America don't really divide themselves on those ideological or even regional lines. You know, we've lost 160,000 people almost to COVID, many of them in cities, many of them in suburbs, many of them in rural America. Last year, we lost 71,000 souls to drug addiction and overdose. Some of them in the cities, some of them in suburbs, some of them in the rural areas. 38,000 dead by gun violence, some in the cities, some in the suburbs, some in the rural areas. And so what Trump wants to do is divide because that helps him politically. But what Democrats need to do is not answer his division with more division, but with unity. And again, I just can't say enough about Ms. Bush, flush from victory in a primary and already talking about the kind of unity that I think Democrats need.
I'm talking with Kimberly Atkins, member of the Boston Globe editorial board, and Paul Begala. He's a Democratic political strategist and a commentator for CNN and a professor of public policy at Georgetown University. And we're talking about the way forward for Democrats and this sort of addition, this growing addition of progressive energy. Let us know what you think. You can post your comments on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, and On Point Radio. Paul, you know, you have helped design victories for Democrats, from Bill Clinton to Barack Obama. You also designed TV and radio ads for Hillary Clinton that really pummeled Donald Trump. And in your new book, which is called You're Fired, you say that you now regret making those ads. And I want to ask you why, but we're not going to play the ad, but I'm just going to describe it. I think if this is the ad you're talking about. So it was basically a montage of Trump talking in really crude ways about women. And it was just Trump sort of being offensive, being offensive, being offensive. And then the voice comes on and says, does he really speak for you? Why do you sort of rethink that kind of strategy, that not being a good approach to going after Donald Trump?
Well, yeah, not because it wasn't true or fair. It was both, but because it wasn't effective. And it wasn't effective. We tested in focus groups. Focus groups thought it was great. Nobody, well, I shouldn't say that. Most Americans don't like that kind of misogyny, the kind of vicious things Trump said. But what I failed to do is I failed to connect it up to people's lives. I was advising a super PAC that was supporting Hillary. The cycle before that, we were supporting President Obama. And when we were doing attacks for President Obama on Mitt Romney, we never attacked Romney's character because he's fundamentally a good person. We attacked his business deals, which looked terrible from a middle-class economic point of view. We should have done that with Trump. In other words, this epiphany that I had was I thought about a farm family in the Midwest, you know, in Wisconsin, where my wife's from. And her family are dairy farmers there. And I thought, you know, 3-4 weeks before the election, they would have seen our ads. And Harold would have said to Ethel, well, you know, Ethel, we can't vote for a fella like that. That's hateful. But about 3 days before the election, I could see Ethel saying, well, you know, he's not going to grab me by the privates. But he says he's going to reopen that factory where they laid off our son, Harvey. So I didn't connect it up to people's lives. And my plea here for Democrats is to learn from that. And don't be diverted simply by Trump's sewer-level character. I mean, I can't stand the guy, okay? I'll be honest. But rather than simply talk about his character, talk about his policies, about the people who are dead, the lives that are shattered because of what he has done as president, not because what he says on Twitter.
Right. Kimberly, what do you think? Does that make sense to you, or do you have a follow-up to Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with what Paul said, certainly. I mean, a re-election of a president is by nature a referendum. It gives voters a chance to ask themselves, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? So I think particularly now that you have 4 years of policy that has put us, I can't think of a single American who feels better off than they were 4 years ago, given the raging pandemic, given the ensuing economic near collapse, given the, I hate to keep using the word reckoning with race, but just a reexamination of systemic racism in this nation. I can't think of anybody who thinks that they are better off than they are now, and examining those policies and for Democrats to really message on failures in his leadership, I think certainly is something that they ought to do. But I think you can walk and chew gum at the same time. When you have a president who is using his Twitter feed and the podium of the White House to espouse just openly racist policies and sentiment, when you have a president who seems to be openly grifting, trying to hawk his own companies, when you have a president who is, speaking ill about our international allies and embracing autocrats, I think all of those things can be on the table in the Democrats' messaging and leading up to an election to say this person doesn't deserve another term.
We're talking about the future of the Democratic Party and the march of the progressive wing of late with Paul Begala and Kimberly Atkins. A lot more to come when we return. We're going to hear from Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. So stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow is our weekly news roundtable. We want to know what's on your mind. How is your community dealing with the coronavirus? How has it affected your life? Do you live in a state that had a primary this week? What was it like voting? Tell us your stories. Give us your questions for our panelists at 617-353-0683. Again, that's 617-353-0683. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party has scored some impressive wins in recent years and in recent days, and we're talking about that and what it means for the future of the party, and most pressingly, what it means for the party's prospects in November. My guests this hour are Kimberly Atkins of the Boston Globe and Paul Begala, Democratic strategist and author of the new book, You're Fired, The Perfect Guide to Beating Donald Trump. And Paul and Kimberly, stand by because I want to introduce Representative Democratic Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, who represents Michigan's 13th congressional district. And Congresswoman, thanks for your time. Thanks for joining us.
No, thank you for having me, Anthony.
It's a pleasure to have you. You won your primary this week, fending off a challenge from Brenda Jones, president of the Detroit City Council. So congratulations on that. 2 years ago, you won in a very close race. The margin was a lot bigger this week. What's the big message from your victory?
I mean, I think it's really important for folks to know, you know, it's not just our names that are on the ballot. When you look at, think of Jamal and think of Corey and so many others that are running that don't take corporate PAC money, we're representative of folks that want Medicare for all and the Green New Deal, the, you know, $15 minimum wage increase, stopping structural racism in our country, ending mass incarceration. All of those things are on the ballot, not just our name. You know, our lived experiences and what we bring forward is what folks want. They want that connection to Congress, not just to look differently, but also to feel and talk differently about the issues that matter most to them.
Right. So I want to ask you about the November election and efforts by Democrats to defeat Donald Trump. You was like Cori Bush, you were a Bernie Sanders supporter. How enthusiastic are you about Joe Biden?
I mean, I think I'm enthusiastic about getting rid of Donald Trump. My folks cannot afford, we can't risk another 4 years of Donald Trump. You know, I have the most polluted zip code in the state of Michigan. And one of the first things he did when this pandemic became very real in our country is he decided to pass an executive order to direct the EPA to stop enforcing the Clean Air and the Clean Water Act, which has nothing to do. I mean, if anything, during this pandemic is when we need to fight back corporate pollution and environmental racism. And so for many of our folks, what's really important, what's on the ballot, like I said, it's not names. Hmm. It's what it represents. And for us, having a president that isn't Donald Trump is very important to my residents right now.
Right. Congresswoman, after your election a couple of years ago, you famously called for the impeachment of the president using a vulgar epithet that we can't repeat on this program. So respond to the idea that what Democrats really need to win in November might be a less confrontational approach than what you represented, at least on that day.
I think for people, as you directed it, it's very much policing, you know, my words and policing women of color that are in politics, or even policing people that are angry and passionate and trying to take those words. I think what you heard is a mother of two Muslim boys in our country that was very frustrated and very angry about the hate agenda coming out of the Oval Office and the fact that so many people were dismissing it. So many people were saying, well, he's doing this or that, or he's keeping his promise. These kind of rationalizing away the racism, rationalizing away that he's invoking white supremacy in our country. I think, you know, for many of us, it's not these categories y'all are keep, you know, referring to many of us. It's really that, God, there's people like us, regular folks, you know, people like us that are not running for office, and people are kind of tired of it. You know, we're tired of the same old, not kind of speaking like reflecting that anger that you feel, that pain you feel, and the hurt you feel in the streets, and bringing that. I mean, I love when one of my residents said to me, "You make me feel liberated, Rashida. You make me feel freer." Why? Because I'm speaking in a way that I think she just needs to feel like, okay, somebody gets the urgency. Mm. Somebody gets and understand that we have no time to wait. We're tired of waiting.
One more question before I let you go. Sometimes big elections come down to one simple idea. I mean, before I ask this question, I would say it's unfortunate, perhaps, but it seems to be true. I mean, for example, Donald Trump latched on to this idea of draining the swamp, and there's lots of evidence he hasn't delivered on that. But he tapped into a sort of essential idea of corruption that resonated with a lot of people back in 2016. So my question to you, what's the one simple idea that Democrats need to push in order to help them win in November?
Yeah, I want to say this. It wasn't that for Trump. I think he tapped into anger. Mm. He tapped into the fact that many people felt very much that government wasn't about them. And he agreed with that, even though he's very much behind that curtain, profiting off of our pain and off of our oppression. He pretended he wasn't like that, but he was absolutely one of the people, and currently you can see it. I mean, he's running his businesses out of the Oval Office. We have a crooked CEO as president of the United States. But I think for us, you know, for many of us that are winning in these elections, you know, it is the human contact, the direct contact to people and hearing them and then not selling them out. I think, you know, it is hard when you say you're for environmental justice, but you're taking money from the same people that are poisoning our air and our water. I think that, you know, people need to be able to trust us, to be able to have this connection with us. You know, I'm the eldest of 14, Anthony, been taking care of people all my life. My father only had fourth grade education, my mother eighth grade. We grew up in a UAW household. My father never understood what it meant to really just have human dignity until he became part of a union. We're just losing touch from that, I think, as Democrats. We're losing, you know, that connection that we had with the working class, and we need to get back to that. I mean, we don't even talk about the P word enough, poverty. Poverty is what's killing us. People focus so much on who killed George Floyd, which is absolutely important, police brutality, for sure. But what about what killed George Floyd? What are we doing to set up the system against our black neighbors across our country? You know, this uprising that is happening is real, and we need to connect to that pain. We connect that hurt and make sure that it translates into meaningful action.
All right. Democratic Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. She represents Michigan's 13th congressional district. Congresswoman, thank you so much for your time today. And again, congratulations on your win this week.
Thank you so much, Anthony. Take care.
Yeah, it was good talking to you. Paul Begala, quick question. What did you hear there?
I heard an appeal that could work in rural America as well as in urban America. That's the key. You know, Republicans, like particularly this president, they're wedge issues. He loves to divide. And he began, of course, his presidency attacking Congresswoman Tlaib's faith as a Muslim. And he's continued to divide ever since. He thinks that's the right way. The way for Democrats to respond is the way Congresswoman Tlaib did. Every American should be against the special interest money that she talked about. And I love that Nancy Pelosi's first bill when she became speaker again was the For the People Act, which is sweeping reform. But, you know, healthcare was passed. Medicaid expansion, which is an Obamacare idea, was passed by Missouri this week. One of the reddest states in America passed Obamacare by popular referendum. A few weeks ago, Oklahoma passed it. Oklahoma is a state where Barack Obama carried zero counties. Hillary Clinton carried zero counties. So my point is the pain doesn't know ideological lines. And Democrats can I think, offer a compelling alternative against Trump's division with their unity. And by unity, I don't mean kumbaya touchy-feely. I mean the beloved community that John Lewis told us about, which is they can take it the same message to Congresswoman Tlaib's district about healthcare, about reform. And they can take that to rural America and do a whole lot better there than they've done in the past, because I think it shows them respect. You know, 77% of rural counties in America are primary healthcare professional shortages. They lack healthcare professionals. That's the same as the inner city. So that's my pitch, is that I think Biden is very well positioned to try to unify his party and now unify the country.
And getting back, and
can I jump in?
Please do, Kimberly. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I'm from Michigan, and I think the point that Paul is making is super important. Yes, Congresswoman Tlaib's district takes up a big chunk of her district is Detroit, but it also includes the surrounding suburbs around Detroit, which is a very working class and segregated place. I'm looking it up right now. About a third of her district is white, and these are the same folks who they were called Reagan Democrats. They were union workers who got disillusioned, particularly the rank and file, and cast their votes. Even though they were registered Democrats for people like Ronald Reagan, and many of them cast their votes for Donald Trump. Donald Trump won Michigan by 10,000 votes in 2016. And the message that she is giving, you're talking about these voters that may switch back and forth, she's tapping into those voters. And the fact that she won re-election with a much bigger margin than she even won her initial election shows that message really does have broad appeal. And Paul's exactly right. You can take that same message to a lot of communities across the country, and it can be a winning one.
I want to ask you both the same question. I'll start with you, Paul, that I asked the Congresswoman, Tlaib. I mean, she sort of disagreed with my premise, and that's okay. But this idea that voters latch on to simple messages, I mean, I think Donald Trump's drain the swamp message meant an awful lot to a lot of people. And polling showed that corruption was always on the top of people's concerns. And whether or not he delivered on it, it was sort of a powerful message. So it seems like Democrats did really well in 2018 because they had such a simple message around healthcare. It was like, right, we want to give it to you. He wants to take it away. That was it. And they won the House on that. They won back the House on that. So what is the sort of super simple message that Democrats need to offer?
If I were to reduce it to three words, I would say for the people. That's what Nancy Pelosi says. That's what she called that first bill, that sweeping reform and voting rights bill, the For the People Act. And Speaker Pelosi led the greatest midterm success Democrats have had since Watergate, the highest voter turnout in a midterm in a century since women got the right to vote. Something was going on. By the way, 41 seats were flipped all by moderates. So the moderate wing of the Democratic Party is strong, and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is strong, as we're seeing in this week. So to me, the Democrats have to get back to what Rashida Tlaib was saying. We ought to be for the folks on the factory floor and on the farms. We ought to be for the office workers and the retirees. And it's that sort of message. We're for the people. They're for the special interests. I do think Trump did get traction. I think you're right, Anthony. He got some real traction with this drain the swamp. And then, as I document in the book, 187 lobbyists from special interests he put in charge of our government, coal lobbyists, oil lobbyists, pharmaceutical lobbyists, health insurance lobbyists. So he didn't drain the swamp. He swamped the drain. And Washington is now overwhelmed. And Democrats ought to run on that. It is probably a challenge for Joe because he was in the Senate for 311 years before he became vice president. But that kind of bracing reform, Nancy Pelosi passed it through the House and it stalled in the Senate because of the Republicans. I think Democrats can run on reform and win.
Kimberly, I'd love to give you a chance to answer that question, agreeing or disagreeing with my premise.
No, I think that is right. I mean, I think Democrats are in a more difficult position as they usually are in that they have to bring together a much broader coalition of folks and energize them all to get them to the polls. You know, I'm not taking away from the point that Paul made, that is exactly right, that I think there is a civil war happening with Republicans, but there are things that they coalesce around, like conservative judges and other things that sort of make it a little easier to galvanize them, even though the Republican Party is shrinking, they're easier to galvanize. Whereas the Democrats, it's a lot. You have to appeal to a lot of different people. You have to make sure that you're listening to Black voters, listening to rural voters, listening to urban voters, listening to suburbanites. It's a lot tougher. But I think with a lot of these messages that get to these basic principles, I don't think it's just one simple reason, Anthony. Mm. I think it's the basic principles of people who are not being able to live the life that they want to live, and real policies being put forward that sound good, and voters saying, hey, let's give these things a try, whether it's on climate change, whether it's on social justice reform, whether it's on healthcare reform. At the beginning of this race, I really thought, how are you going to run against Obamacare? Like, we just spent 10 years hearing Democrats say how important Obamacare is. Now you want to throw it all out. I feel differently now. I think voters are open to at least hearing the case for throwing it out and bringing in something new. If it's going to help people get health care, as tens of millions of them lost health care because they lost their jobs. Mm. I think that if you go to these fundamental principles of making people's lives better that Paul talked about, that can really be a deeply resonating message and actually make it easier for Joe Biden to make that case across the board to a lot of different kind of voters who are looking for different things.
So, Paul, speaking of making that case, of Joe Biden making that case, in your book, you talk about the importance of avoiding the Trump trap. What is that?
Well, it is being so distracted by his, in my eyes, sewer level personal character that we lose sight of the simple indictment on the record. I mean, Kimberly talked about this earlier. An incumbent president must first be assessed on his record. It's really a two-step process. This is where it's very different from 2016. And people who think we're rerunning the 2016 race are wrong. The 2016 was an open seat presidential race. When you have an incumbent, and I helped Bill Clinton get reelected, I helped Barack Obama get reelected. When you have an incumbent president, the first question is, play him or trade him? Do we keep him or look for somebody new? The American people are ready now to look for somebody new. Democrats have to make the case first that, yeah, we got to fire him, but then they got to make the case of what they're for. And Biden's starting to do that. I thought he had quite a good speech, this Build Back Better plan. You should know, and your audience should know, I don't advise any politicians anymore. So I'm not just like flacking for Joe. Mm-hmm. But his economic plan, I thought, was quite good. It embodied a lot of the sort of populism that you just heard Congresswoman Tlaib talk about. He criticized Trump's tax cuts for corporate America. One of the great lines in there is that the days of Amazon paying zero taxes are over in a Biden presidency. That could have been said by Bernie Sanders or Bill Clinton. In other words, the Democrats are more united, I think, than people give them credit for.
Really, really interesting. Paul Begala, Democratic strategist, political commentator at CNN, and author of a new book. And I'm looking for the title. There it is. You're Fired. The Perfect
You're
Guide.
You're Fired. It's a catchphrase.
I got it. The Perfect Guide to Beating Donald Trump. Paul, thank you so much. Such a pleasure to talk to you.
What a pleasure, Anthony. Thank you. And Kimberly, thank you.
And Kimberly Atkins, member of the Boston Globe editorial board and a longtime political journalist, joined us from Washington, D.C. Kimberly, always great to have you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Anthony. This was great. And thanks to Paul and the winning candidates as well.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also download us. You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook and On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Thank you.